Welcome into the Ether, a podcast focusing on all things Ethereum, the leading blockchain for decentralized applications. I'm Eric Connor, your host and founder of ETHHub, a decentralized information hub for Ethereum. Into the Ether features deep dives on topics with prominent guests in the community, as well as ETHHub weekly recaps featuring Anthony Cesano. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the ETHHub Weekly Recap. In these episodes, Anthony and I discuss the ETHHub Weekly newsletter, which covers recent events in both the Ethereum ecosystem and crypto space as a whole. Today, we will be discussing the news from January 14th to January 20th, 2019. Hey, Anthony, how's it going?
Hey, Eric, I'm good. How are you?
Good, good. Let's talk about some news.
Yeah. First, I just wanted to mention one thing. Everyone would have noticed in the newsletter that we're now on Substack, which is our new email delivery platform. So you can read the newsletter on ethub.substack.com or just wait for it to hit your inbox. It basically gets published at the same time. Now I'll move on to the news. So the first bit of news I wanted to talk about was the Cryptopia hack. So Cryptopia is a New Zealand-based exchange. They're not the greatest exchange. They list a lot of, I'll just say it, shitcoins. They had a lot of the old Bitcoin forks on there. So if you remember from 2013, 2014, even earlier, the Bitcoin forks were just basically renamed and pretty much all scams. So Cryptopia had them on there. It wasn't a big exchange, but they did. They are claiming they got hacked to the tune of, I can't remember the exact figure, but it was millions of dollars. So they've shuttered the site. No one's obviously able to withdraw. And I think it just highlights, you know, another point with regards to decentralized exchanges, non-custodial exchanges, and why we need them. These exchanges, they keep getting hacked all the time. There's, you know, famously MT Gox, Cripsy. There's been others in there, like even places like Bitfinex got hacked, you know, or in the case of Cripsy, the owner just ran away with the funds. So yeah, I thought it was just another nail in the coffin for centralized exchanges.
Yeah, you mentioned Cripsy. That's kind of when I saw the news break, that's what this reminded me of. That was kind of one of the original smaller altcoin exchanges back in the day, and people lost a lot of crypto, which at the time maybe in a USD amount wasn't worth too much, but now today it would have been. Yeah, so I guess they were based in New Zealand. I didn't know too much about Cryptopia. I guess they're kind of close to you over there in Futureland near Australia, but yeah, I guess it's not known yet if it's a hack or an exit scam. I'm assuming a smaller exchange that's listing these kind of tokens probably doesn't have the proper security in place that they should. So something we seem to see a lot in these cases are usually it's some type of inside job, like maybe someone has access to the hot or cold wallet keys, or you know, intercepts them during a transfer, whatever it might be. But I wouldn't be surprised to see it maybe be some kind of internal person. That's obviously complete speculation, and I hope it's, well, I guess it doesn't matter at this point if it's a hack or exit scam. Exit scam seems a little bit worse to me. Hack would just be kind of not having their ducks in a row, and exit scam is obviously much worse than that. Yeah, I mean, I'm sure a lot of people lost some money in this, unfortunately. And like you mentioned, I mean, once again, it's, I can't say it enough, don't keep your crypto on an exchange unless you're literally day trading it and you need it there for that reason. There's absolutely no reason to keep your crypto on an exchange. I mean, hardware wallets have come down in cost so much. You can get one of those, you can just send it there and, you know, hide it, store it wherever you want, and you never have to worry about someone stealing your funds. So hopefully we continue to kind of learn these lessons and people switch to hardware wallets as well as using decentralized exchanges for this, instead of this centralized custody, these centralized exchanges. And I think that's going to start to really happen once we start to see layer two scaling solutions hit decentralized exchanges when they can handle more volume.
Yeah, for sure. I totally agree. I think, so I guess decentralized exchanges still suffer from liquidity problems. They're definitely nowhere near as liquid as the centralized counterparts. A lot of them basically only work within Ethereum. So with Ether and the tokens that live on Ethereum, they don't work cross blockchain with, you know, say Bitcoin or any of the other coins or tokens out there, which I think is another big reason why people aren't using them. But, you know, as you said, we're going to have layer two tech that scales this. We're going to have more improvements coming along on the front end, UI, UX. And eventually we'll have bridges between blockchains, which allow this kind of atomic swaps between the chains. You know, there's already a few projects trialing that. We've got WBTC, which bridges Bitcoin to Ethereum. That's coming out relatively soon. A few other projects in the space doing the same thing. So yeah, it'll be really interesting to see how decentralized exchanges evolve from here. People, yeah, as you said, people really should not be keeping any crypto on an exchange. As Andreas Antonopoulos has said, you know, famously said, not your keys, not your crypto. And that's true for any cryptocurrency you own, or, you know, even just keeping it on a custody solution or wherever else. Yeah, it might be yours in name, but, you know, if they get hacked or it gets stolen or some other thing happens, then, you know, you're out of luck, unfortunately. As we know, blockchain transactions are irreversible most of the time. depending, you know, they can be reversed, but no one's going to reverse it for us, you know, just you losing your money, unfortunately. We've seen it already happen with something as big as the Parity, you know, multi-sig wallet, locking hundreds of millions of dollars in there, and that hasn't been reversed yet or anything. You know, it could be in the future, but, you know, Parity has to kind of progress without those funds for now and you know, basically not rely on those funds ever being unlocked, as the community has basically said they didn't want to do that. So, yeah, end of the day, keep your coins on a highway wallet or some other kind of off exchange solution. There's many out there, and we've got a few guides on ETH Hub around this actually as well in the wallet section, so if you wanted to check that out too. Cool. So I'll move on to the next bit of news. So there was an interesting bit of news that came out around a crypto gaming startup called Planet Digital Partners. They kind of exited stealth this week. It was interesting to see that they have former members of the studios behind Grand Theft Auto, Guitar Hero, and PlayStation as well. They're actually doing a security token offering. I think they're raising $32 million. Obviously, if you're in the US, you have to be an accredited investor. I think there's a minimum investment of $25,000. It could be $50,000. I can't remember exactly. But it's interesting to see this security token concept play out in real time with kind of real legitimate people behind it, and not just maybe someone trying to raise money for an ICO, not ICO, we'll just rename it to security token, you know, to skirt some more regulations. So yeah, it was really interesting to see this week. What did you think of it, Eric?
This is definitely cool. I mean, I guess a couple of things here. First, I think gaming on Ethereum is a sleeping giant for sure. I think we're starting to see a lot of development around this, and it's kind of perfect in my mind for, you know, creating non-fungible tokens for goods on games. And then we talked last week kind of then interoperability between games. So we're seeing a partnership between CryptoKitties and Gods Unchained. I know that Planet Digital mentioned this in one of the press releases I read, just this interoperability that it creates and people being able to own an item in one game that's unique to them and putting in another, that it seems like that's a huge potential business. So I think gaming, like I mentioned, is definitely a sleeping giant we're going to kind of see awaken over the next few months. And also, I'm very bullish on the idea of security tokens. I wasn't a fan of the ICO craze at all. I didn't buy into a single ICO. And the reason is because they didn't offer any type of rights to either the company, voting rights. Well, I guess if you want to split hairs, there are some governance tokens out there, but that's for another 45-minute debate. But with security tokens, you actually have rights to, you know, certain parts of the company, whether it's ownership or the revenue stream or the profit that they're making. So that really makes you really you're really actually a part of the company at this point, which is not what we saw at all in the ICO craze last year, well, in 2017. So I think there's a lot of cool stuff here. I mean, not only are there big names from big games that are doing this, but I think they're doing it the right way through security tokens. And it seems like they have a pretty cool vision in mind.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting you bring up kind of the, you know, the rights that token holders or, you know, security token holders have. As you said, ICOs didn't really give you any rights unless there was some kind of on-chain governance component. We haven't really seen that play out on a massive scale. I think the only one that I've seen play out at scale relative to the rest of the ecosystem is MakerDAO, and they didn't even do an ICO. So I think that's saying something. But with this STO or security token offering, they're actually offering a share of the company. Obviously, you'll be able to get any of the profits they make, you'll have a share in. So it's really good to see this happening. And I think a main reason why this didn't happen in 2017 or even in 2018 is just the regulatory clarity is still not there. You know, it wasn't there at all in 2017, 2018. We've made a little bit of progress, I think. Definitely not enough to say anything concrete yet. But it's interesting to see these startups just going for it anyway. I'm not an expert on kind of the legals behind it, but I'm sure they're registered in some jurisdiction or setting up some kind of company that allows them to do this. to accept investment from, you know, all these types of participants. It's obviously not anonymous investment. There will be KYC involved and things like that. But it's still good to see this evolution of ICOs, if you will, you know, play out in a legitimate way, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the regulation side, that's a great point. It's going to take a little while for the infrastructure for proper security raising to happen. And as you mentioned, they have KYC, they're registered legally in a jurisdiction they know that they can do this in. And as that kind of gets built out more and more, we're going to see, I believe, eventually we're going to definitely see a boom in these security raisings, because the platform itself on Ethereum still just offers so much as far as global reach, frictionless, permission. You can have fractional ownage of sharing in a company. So there's a lot of cool benefits still that I think, you know, take the ICO, everyone kind of has a bad taste about ICO, take that out. We say a lot, don't get mad at the platform Ethereum itself. It just enabled all of these things to happen. And it kind of, as the infrastructure gets built out to do this properly, I think we're going to see another boom there for sure.
Yeah, exactly. I always joke about, you know, people getting mad about Ethereum being used for ICOs is like people getting mad that Bitcoin was used to buy drugs in the early days.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. All right. So the last bit of news, you know, it's a bit bittersweet to talk about this. The Constantinople network upgrade for Ethereum was delayed this week due to, I've seen the words abundance of caution used a lot through everything that I've read. It was basically due to one of the EIPs, Ethereum Improvement Proposals, having a vulnerability in it. It was EIP-1283. This was going to introduce cheaper gas cost for store operations. It's quite technical, but basically some smart contracts that were already on chain may utilize code patterns that would make them vulnerable to a re-entrancy attack after the upgrade took place. So about 48 hours before the upgrade was due to go live, it was called off. We actually recorded a whole segment on Constantinople and how excited we were on the podcast last week, but we decided to cut it at the last minute, which is lucky timing, I guess, because we were putting the podcast out just as this was announced. So, but yeah, it was funny to see this happen so quickly, basically. And of course, there was lots of, you know, FUD on Twitter from various parties saying, oh, Ethereum centralized because they can just pick and choose when they do an upgrade. But it definitely wasn't that. You know, they basically just gave the recommendation for people to update their node software to run the patched version, which didn't include the Constantinople upgrade. And, you know, people could still run the Constantinople chain if they wanted to. And it was actually interesting. I sat and watched the live stream. I know you did too, Eric, where they watched Constantinople actually kick in at the original block. And there was actually 6 blocks mined. You know, there were some people that were still mining on that chain, running the Constantinople software. So it just goes to show that no one was forced to upgrade their software. It wasn't like the dev said, you need to upgrade or else, you know, you're not going to be able to do what you want. It's not like that at all. And I think people need to realize that. So yeah, so that chain has since died off. Those 6 blocks were mined over the course of a few hours. And on the live stream, Hudson Jameson was taking a shot every time that happened. It's quite funny to watch that. But yeah, so what did you think of all this, Eric?
Yeah, well, first of all, I don't know about you, but Vitalik broke down my door. I tweeted and he forced me to upgrade my node. So clearly this whole thing is centralized, but he must have just not made it to Australia. I was literally editing the podcast last week and I was going through our Constantinople session where we were all excited and basically partying that it was about a day away. And then I saw a notification from someone, hey, I think there's a problem. And I jumped into the core devs Gitter and sure enough, there was a major problem. So I had to cut that out. So we had to put the party hats and champagne away for another month and a half or so. But yeah, I mean, this is obviously disappointing. I'm not going to lie. This is the second delay. So we're going on a third attempt here. This is now 5 months of delay. Obviously, one of the big things we talk about a lot here is the reduction in block rewards to kind of get the issuance rate on the network in check from 7.5% down to 4.5%. You know, if you kind of, it's not fully fair because the difficulty bombs kicked in now, but if you look at 5 months delay, that's costing about 890,000 Ether in extra issuance as if we would have been on time for this. So, you know, kind of from a stakeholder and investor perspective of this, it's disappointing. That being said, it's definitely better to be safe than sorry. And I definitely respect the devs and I know they're trying their hardest to get this in. So that's by no means any kind of jab at them. And, you know, at the time when this came out, there was only about a day left until the fork, if that, I think at that point. So it was kind of, you know, they weren't sure of the stretch of it. You can kind of think of it in a way like the DAO attack was. So it's a re-entry attack where someone can drain the smart contract. So it was just hard to know what smart contracts were vulnerable. So now it's been decided to strip this out, and we have a 6 month or 6 week delay, hopefully not 6 months, who knows at this point. But February 27th is the new targeted. One interesting thing here is the difficulty bomb is actually kicked in and active now. So right now, every 100,000 blocks, the difficulty of to mine a block on Ethereum is going up, and hash rate's staying pretty much the same, maybe even down a tiny bit over this time since it's been kicking in. So we're seeing rises in block time every 100,000 blocks. And yesterday we hit block 7.1 million, which means that it popped up again, and we're at, I believe I just looked, we're at like about 17 second block time. So we're up from, we had stabilized around 13 and a half to 14 for a while, and we're all the way up to 17 now. I think by the time the fork hits, assuming we hit it on February 27th, we're going to be somewhere around 20, 22 seconds or something like that. But we have to get it in soon, or the chain is essentially going to freeze.
Yeah, exactly. It's interesting you bring up the difficulty bomb. It reminds me of the last hard fork or network upgrade, Byzantium. We reached, I think the difficulty bomb kicked in as well then, and we were up to 30 second blocks, and it was just, it was quite bad from a user experience perspective. I remember, you know, interacting with Ethereum and basically having to wait double the amount of time I would usually wait, and I felt like I was drowning. And then when that, and there ended up being like a massive backlog of transactions as well. And obviously this was during the boom of 2017, so there was a lot more use on the network, you know, ICOs were still going and things like that, so it did clog the chain. And then, you know, Byzantium went through, and then the chain was kind of, I mean, I didn't feel like I was drowning anymore, came up for air basically. Those transactions were filtered through. So, you know, I'm not sure exactly on the calculations here, but I think we might approach similar block times by the time the Constantinople network rolls out. And I really do hope we get it right this time, as another delay will just result in longer blocks and as you said, eventually freeze the chain.
Yeah, definitely. What's interesting here is that we actually hit a point where the issuance gets worse on the current chain because blocks are slower. So we're issuing less, even though each block is at 3 ETH, where Constantinople is going to be 2. But because the block times are getting slower, the issuance at a point crosses underneath what it'll be in Constantinople. I think that's around like 22 second blocks or so. So we're actually not that far away. Pretty much by the time we fork to Constantinople now, the issuance will be higher on that chain than the current chain. But of course, you can't live with the slow block times increasing and increasing by any means. I mean, one thing that's interesting here, and I'll bring up that I saw an announcement, I think they're called the Cat Herders, and Afri from Parity is kind of going to be the release manager now for the releases. It seems that the times between releases are kind of going up exponentially in Ethereum. I don't know if that's just due to more people or in more groups involved or us trying to get a hold of governance. I'm not sure why that's happening, but if you look at the dates for all the forks, it's essentially in between the months that they happen. It's essentially going up exponentially. So hopefully this effort of the, I believe it's called the Cat Herders, and I know Afri is kind of in charge of release management now, which is great because I think we need it. You know, he's been around for a long time. He's a very important voice for us in the ecosystem, and we kind of need a group to push and kind of project and product manage these forks, because I think they're just getting dragged out a little bit too long at this point.
Yeah, interesting you mentioned the Cat Herders. That was actually announced today, so it didn't make the newsletter that I sent out yesterday, but it will be in next week's, or you can just basically, I guess, Google Cat Herders Ethereum. It should come up by the time this podcast comes out. But yeah, I do agree with you. It does feel like these upgrades are getting longer, or taking longer. And that's kind of why I'm glad that ETH 2.0 is being developed in parallel to ETH 1.0. So they're actually pretty unrelated in terms of development timelines. You know, as you mentioned, Afri is now in charge of basically various different things on the ETH 1.0 chain and organizing the devs on that chain. And obviously the 1.x upgrades as well. But then we've also got the ETH 2.0 chain, which is like 9 teams building that out now. And a lot of the core researchers are working on that as well. So I'm not, I don't think the longer upgrade times are that much of a concern for the next maybe couple of years, I guess. It really depends how things play out. Like, we do want to get the 1.0 chains issuance down over time, especially if we start using the Beacon chain to checkpoint the the 1.0 proof of work chain. We do want to get issuance down eventually to maybe one ETH or less, depending on what's needed for security, basically.
Yeah, and I guess one final point on this, I would ask anybody, no one's trying to drag this stuff out. And I see a lot of people taking their anger out on the devs on Twitter and Reddit and stuff. Like, that's not helping anything. Everyone wants to get this out. Just because there's a 6-week delay doesn't mean, you know, people are being lazy, don't want to get out. There's a lot that's involved in stripping this EIP out. The testnets had all forked, so we have to fix the testnets. We have to go through all the testing again. There's a lot involved. So, in my opinion, the worst thing we can do is, you know, kind of attack the people that are working on this. So I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah, totally agree. Nothing I dislike more than random people on Twitter attacking the devs doing the actual work, if I'm being brutally honest. So yeah, definitely don't do that. You can attack me and Eric if you want, and we'll just tell you where to go to find more information.
Yes, please attack us. We enjoy it.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So I'll move on to the project updates from the week. First thing I want to talk about was MakerDAO announcing that their Oasis DEX, DEX and Oasis Direct will be shut down by the end of the month due to regulatory uncertainty. They cite like a changing regulatory landscape as the reason why, and they plan to replace this with a new exchange called ETH2DAI. So basically an exchange ETH and DAI, but there won't be the MKR token on there. So they are planning to relaunch these two services sometime in the future. They didn't really specify a time. They said after Multicollateral DAI goes live, so maybe in the next few months. But yeah, the post itself was a bit ambiguous in the reasons why, but it's clear that they are being proactive about this instead of reactive, so that they don't run into regulatory troubles down the line. You know, it seems like the token itself might be what's causing some troubles there, but I can't say for sure. It's just all speculation basically on my part.
Yeah, it definitely reeks a bit of someone getting hit with maybe a slap or a warning for KYC and regulation potentially. I don't know. Again, just speculation there, but just feels like it. I mean, Oasis DEX is great. I know a lot of people that use it and it's done its purpose, but it also wasn't perfect, right? It's kind of one of those slower DEXs that we're all used to at this point. Hopefully they're looking at a way to improve this. They have this ETH to DAI thing that's coming out as well. And, you know, obviously contracts are still out there and someone's going to take this Oasis DEX contract and spin it up on IPFS, give it an ENS domain and do it anonymously. And no one's going to be in charge of that. And it's going to live on forever, right? I don't really see there to be a reason for that not to happen. I know that Maker puts a timeout in their exchanges, but that's easy. You could fork it. You could, I believe even their UI front end was open source. You could fork the contract, rip the expiration date out, fork the UI repo, and then just host it on an IPFS and buy an ENS domain. So I can pretty much guarantee that's going to happen and Oasis will probably live on.
Yeah, I definitely agree. I fully expect it. I'll be very surprised if it doesn't happen, actually, considering that there is money to be made. Interesting if they were to put it on IPFS and had an ENS name attached, it pretty much becomes like the ultimate decentralized exchange. But even if they don't go that far, they can always just host it in a jurisdiction, you know, that isn't as ambiguous with regulations or is more loose, or they just don't care, basically. Given that the internet is a global thing, means crypto is a global thing, they can host the site wherever they want, basically. But yeah, I fully expect something to come, maybe even on the day Oasis DEX gets shut down, we just see a new one pop up basically and everyone just migrates there. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see if that happens or not.
Yeah, and one other thing they had mentioned was wanting to do some type of fiat on-ramp. So I'll be curious how that looks. I believe they have some type of partnership with Wire now where you can kind of do fiat to DAI and DAI to fiat transactions. So it'll be interesting to see if they bring that partnership into play somehow.
Yeah, and for fiat, they would obviously need to do KYC, AML and all that. So, you know, it becomes obvious the reason why they've shut down, they're shutting down these two current platforms and relaunching, basically. So the next thing I wanted to talk about was the Parity Feather beta. So this is basically a light wallet that you can download. It's made by Parity Technologies, and it connects to random public Ethereum nodes instead of something like Infura. It's really great to see more work being done on this sort of stuff. Ethereum itself gets attacked a lot for being too reliant on services like Infura, which basically act as a centralization point. You know, there are a lot of dApps that rely on Infura because running an archive node, which is what's needed for a lot of dApps, can be quite difficult at times. And, you know, querying for data becomes quite hard. And there are other projects tackling this sort of thing, like the Graph protocol for querying blockchain data and things like that. But Parity Feather is just a light wallet similar to MetaMask, where instead of connecting to, Infura connects to publicly available Ethereum nodes. So further decentralizes that kind of aspect of wallets without you needing to download or run a full node yourself.
Yeah, this is cool. I haven't tried it out yet, but I definitely plan to check it out this week. I agree with you. I go back and forth on the Infura thing. I mean, we definitely have to be honest with ourselves. We don't want Ethereum to just become this centralized place where everyone's wallets and nodes and dApps are hooking into the same provider, right? So Infura is basically serving up their, you can think of it as they're running their own nodes and they're serving those up to people that need to read from them. So they're kind of taking care of the infrastructure side of things. The argument is, and doing that essentially in Infura is kind of a centralized point of failure, right? Now, the counter to that is I personally run my own node. I hook all of my dApps into that node locally. So even though a lot of the dApps maybe will ship hooked up by default to Infura, say something like MetaMask, I don't think Augur by default does anymore, but I do know at a point they did. You can just point that to your own node on wherever you're running it and run it that way. So there's ways around it. I do know it's pretty heavily relied upon. I know at a point they were talking about finding a way to decentralize their infrastructure internally at Infura. But anything we can do like this Parity Feather wallet, which is going into beta now or is in beta now, where that's going to pick publicly available nodes and kind of take that point of centralization out, that's great. I mean, Infura still is always going to hold a spot, and it's been very important to the development of the Ethereum ecosystem, but we just don't want to become too reliant on it where we don't have to be.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, I'm curious to see how this plays out. At the moment, it's just on the Coven testnet, so you can download it, connect it to the Coven testnet and play around with it there. I'm guessing maybe the next few months it'll be on mainnet. So looking forward to that. Cool. So I wanted to give a quick shout out to someone who's worked tirelessly over the last few weeks on publishing something called What's New in ETH 2.0. You would see I include this in the newsletter every week. It's done by Ben Edgington. I hope I said his last name correctly. He works at Consensus in the Pegasus team, which is one of the teams building an ETH 2.0 client. And he basically rounds up all the research, development, you know, new spec changes, things like that in ETH 2.0 for the week. And that's been a massive help for myself, and I know for you, Eric, as well, on keeping on top of everything happening in ETH 2. So just wanted to give a big shout out to Ben for all his hard work getting this together each week.
Yeah, fully agreed. I like the idea of doing shout outs for people that are doing good work, good and helpful work in the community. I mean, there's so much to keep track of, and it's almost impossible if there weren't people offering up good, you know, newsletters or whatever it might be. And Ben's doing a great job on the ETH 2.0 side. And that's not an easy area to kind of, I guess I'll use herd the cats and kind of get all this information together, because all the teams are pretty young and new, and also the information's very complex. So he's doing a great job. Definitely highly recommend following him on Twitter and subscribing to his newsletter. And it's basically just, I mean, I just read it and I feel like I caught up on all the news in ETH 2.0 in the last week or so.
Yeah, exactly. And he tries to break it down as well, so it's not too technical, but he does link to the more technical parts as well, which is just great to keep up to date on. So if you just want to have that one-stop source for Ethereum 2.0 updates, I definitely just recommend checking the What's New in ETH 2.0 each week. That's really all you need to get up to speed. Yeah, so once again, thanks, Ben, for all your work. We hope to see more updates in the next few weeks. So one thing I did want to talk about was the on-chain activity of a few CDPs that I noticed over the past week or so. So there's three or four CDPs, they're large CDPs, that drew large amounts of DAI, so hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of DAI in the last few days. And this is their first interaction with their CDP since the 7th to the 10th of December. Now, I'm speculating here, but I don't know if this is the same person or if they're different people. But it's curious that they all did it at around about the same time with around about the same amounts. So I'm inclined to believe it's one person, but they are basically drawing the die, buying ETH, and then putting that ETH back into their CDP to keep their liquidation price really low. So, you know, we don't talk about the markets and speculation and price too much on the podcast, but I did want to call this out as very interesting to see, because everyone's always trying to call a bottom on the price and like where the price is going to go. And it's, I just like watching what the big CDPs are doing and what they believe is happening with the price, whether they think it's going to go, you know, they're going like ultra long on ETH by just locking up all the ETH they buy into their CDP, still having this massive outstanding debt. Like I'm looking at one of them at the moment and he has $1.5 million of debt outstanding, but he has 40,000 ETH in his CDP with a collateralization ratio of 315% and a liquidation price of $55. Just these things, just they're very interesting to keep track of and see what these big ETH holders are doing from a market and trading perspective, basically.
Yeah, this stuff's really fun to track. I mean, that's what's so nice about it being open. I mean, there's also privacy concerns, but it's kind of fun to just do some sleuthing and kind of have it out in the open where people, especially on the trading side, when you can publicly see people's liquidation points. I mean, it seems to me a lot of these bigger CDPs are technically calling bottom in kind of the $55 to $65 range. Of course, if we get down there, I'm sure they'll add to them, but there's definitely some large pockets at play here on some of these larger CDPs. Kind of a fun fact here, I think it was you maybe tracked one of these. I'm not sure if it's these large ones that have just opened, but back to kind of I've been around ETH Trader for years now, and there's kind of a famous legend of this. If you go on Etherscan, you can even search it. It's called the Accumulator. And it was someone that was buying, you know, upwards of 1 million Ether early on in the days. Huge accumulator. No one really knew who he was. It could have been an exchange, but they were also selling at times too. And it seems like maybe that account woke up at a point and got interested in the CDP party. So it's just fun to kind of poke around and see. There's a lot of big money at play. And it's pretty cool to see that all happening just in a truly decentralized fashion with CDPs.
Yeah, well, I did. I was talking to you about this. I didn't tweet about this, the accumulator, because I wasn't sure, because there's obviously the way you track it is through the blockchains and tracking transactions, things like that. But that doesn't account for over-the-counter transactions. So you can never be sure who owns the address or if it's the same person or things like that. But it did make sense that this accumulator was, it looked like they started buying ETH again, opening CDPs to do so. So it was just fun to track it. It's always, you know, really fun to go through and dig through the data, but because you can't link it to any specific identity easily, like obviously it being not anonymous, if someone slips up and links a real life ID to their address, then you can find it. But most of the time, just looking at the data itself, you won't be able to tell who it is. But yeah, it was just interesting to track that back. And I did that a few weeks ago. I haven't actually looked at that CDP since then. Maybe I should. And then maybe I'll include it in the newsletter next week. If you want to track these things for yourself, go to mkr.tools or makerscan.io. Both great sites made by community members. Really good for tracking this sort of stuff. That's basically what I do. I'm no magician. I can't read the smart contracts and the transactions on the blockchain down to a granular level. I just like the pretty graphs on Maker Tools, if I'm being honest. Yeah, so moving on from that, I did want to mention that I noticed that DDEX, I remember we spoke about this, they were forking off 0x. So that happened in December, I think it was 19th of December, they officially forked off of 0x. And I noticed on 0x tracker that since then, the order fills on 0x have fallen off a cliff. DDEX accounted for about 50 to 60% of the trading volume, I think, at the time. But the actual order fills has dropped more than 50%. So it's obvious that DDEX was accounting for a large chunk of basically everything that was happening on the 0x protocol. And that's why they forked off, I guess. They felt like they were getting a raw deal and they felt like they were strong enough to fork off on their own. It seems that they've been right, as 0x has the trading volumes and the fills have fallen off. So, but that's not to say that 0x is dead or anything. The project is very much alive. They actually published 4 updates this week with new developer tools. They announced the Market Maker program last week, things like that. But it's just interesting to see how people tend to kind of hover around one or two large exchanges. We see this in the centralized exchange space as well. because the liquidity is there. Liquidity is everything. For every DeFi app out there, liquidity is absolutely everything. If you don't have liquidity, your app is just going to, like, maybe not fail, but it's going to get, I mean, we see this already. Augur gets slammed all the time for having low volume. And there's multiple reasons for that. It doesn't need to be as liquid as an exchange. An exchange probably lives or dies on liquidity, because if there's no liquidity, then no one can trade with each other. And then that's all the exchange is there for, basically. So, yeah, it's good to see 0x tackling this with the Market Maker program and things like that. I'm curious to see how it plays out now that DDEX is completely independent and 0x needs to kind of go through a rise from the ashes, basically.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'm a little exhausted on the decentralized exchange space right now. I mean, kind of until we have these layer two solutions, like you mentioned, the liquidity is not there. If you don't have the liquidity on an exchange, you're not going to get users. I don't know if that's a chicken and egg thing. Obviously, you need users for liquidity. But in my opinion, we need scaling and cheaper transactions to get the liquidity. Now, obviously, we had some podcasts. One of them was Starkware, and they're clearly launching an alpha very soon for ZK Starks on a decentralized exchange. I'm extremely excited to see what that looks like, because I think that's going to enable a lot. I think until that point, we're just probably not going to see too much volume on decentralized exchanges. I mean, one thing, we're at a bear market, hopefully near the bottom, but who knows? So there's just a drop in trading volume in general. And using one of these, in all honesty, is pretty painful. You got to put it order in and you've got to pay for that. Then you've got to, if you want to cancel that order, that's another transaction. Their miners can front run you. So if you try to do a large order, you're going to get screwed over somehow on that by front running. And it's just a bit exhausting. I think the only one I kind of use at this point is Uniswap, just because I think it's a cool idea and you can kind of add liquidity yourself, and it's unique. And it's more for just quickly kind of transferring one token into another. It doesn't have a typical exchange order book. But I think once we see these layer two solutions come on board, we're really going to see kind of a boost in decentralized exchanges, because people don't want to lose their coins, and you're not going to run into that problem on a DEX. So once the features come online of speed and lower costs to the DEXs, we're going to see an influx of people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think the major reason why these DEXs don't have liquidity is, scalability. You mentioned layer two solutions coming online to rectify that. That's going to be good to see, because the liquidity is not there, because on centralized exchanges, there's lots of bots and market makers that have really low latency trading, under a second, basically, trading through the APIs and things like that. On decentralized exchanges, you don't currently have that, because a lot of things are done on chain, and it's more expensive too. On a centralized exchange, it's very, very cheap. So the DEX counterparts is going to evolve over time. We're still super early in this kind of world. I know Binance is bringing out a DEX soon, but I doubt it's going to be anywhere near as decentralized as something like the 0x protocol, as they're having their own chain. And I'm not sure if they've released details yet of how that chain is going to be validated, whether it's going to be a kind of EOS style block producers where, Binance controls all the block producers, or there's only a handful of them and it's only trusted parties and things like that. So I'd be curious to see what they do in that space. But if we're talking truly decentralized, or as decentralized as possible, exchanges or non-custodials, we're definitely going to have to wait for layer two solutions to come out before we can see any real scalability and then, liquidity come from that.
Yeah, you mentioned a good point. We see this cycling on centralized exchanges a ton as well. Like back in the day, it was, of course, it was Gox first, and then it was Bitfinex, and then kind of the Chinese exchanges like Kyobi and OKCoin hopped in. Binance kind of took over in 2017. I mean, they're kind of turning into a joke to me. I know they still have a lot of volume and they list all the coins and whatever, but now they're offering XRP pairs and they're coming up with this own decentralized exchange. Who knows how that's going to work? Like you mentioned, they're trying to get back in the ICO scene. I don't know. In my opinion, they're going to fall off a cliff, and we're going to see next bull run, we're going to see in 2020 or whenever it's going to be, we're going to see another exchange pop up. So it's funny how we don't only see this on the decentralized exchange space, but we also see it on the centralized exchange side.
Yeah, exactly. Everything in crypto seems to work in cycles. So it'd be interesting to see if Binance is still the dominant exchange, and what their decentralized exchange looks like. They definitely will be able to bootstrap the liquidity, I think, But at the end of the day, I feel like it's just going to look way more like a centralized exchange than a decentralized exchange, if I'm being honest, because to achieve the scalability that they claim that they're going to have, they're not going to be able to spin up thousands of different nodes with some, you know, proof of work mechanism or proof of stake or whatever, well, without something like sharding, which no blockchain has at the moment because it's still an unsolved problem. So it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. Cool. Last thing I wanted to talk about was a blog post, very interesting blog post, very good blog post that came out this week by James Prestwich. So it's called What to Expect When ETH's Expecting. It's a pretty funny name. It basically runs through ETH 2.0's rollout. So all the various phases, you know, James's reservations, problems that he foresees, and he actually, at the end of the article, suggests some fixes. Vitalik responded to this article on Reddit. I don't think I included it in the newsletter. I apologize. You should just be able to find it on Reddit. I don't have the link handy, but he did think it was a good article, and he offered a few of his own solutions. One thing that James called out was cross-shard composability on ETH 2.0. What this basically is different dApps being able to be on different shards and communicate with each other in a performant manner. So say MakerDAO being on one shard and the 0x protocol being on another shard. Currently in ETH 1.0, everything's on the same blockchain, so they're not split up, so they can talk to each other. Whereas in ETH 2.0, they'll be able to talk to each other still, but it will take a lot longer because they'll have to go through the beacon chain essentially and then go back to the other shard. Vitalik proposed some layer 2 solutions to this. It's still very early days. But yeah, so the overall the article was really great, and it was just very, very interesting because he, at the end of the article, I mean, James, there's no secret, he's known for being a Bitcoiner. Not I don't know if he's a maximalist, but on Twitter he tweets a lot about Bitcoin and actually is very negative about Ethereum a lot of the time. So it's interesting to see him post something like this. It was good to see as well because it was an objective analysis. He doesn't really have, you know, a ball in Ethereum's court, for example. He's more of a Bitcoiner, and a lot of the people he had that reviewed this piece were also Bitcoiners. Someone like Nick Carter, who, you know, he writes a lot of good pieces as well, but he's definitely a Bitcoiner. So it was interesting to see this come from their side and see that you know, some of them really understand what's going on in Ethereum land all the way to ETH 2.0. So it was just great to read through and get another perspective on it, basically.
Yeah, it was a good piece. And like you said, nice objective piece, pretty honest, not too much in there I disagree with per se. There's definitely some challenges that we're going to face on the ETH 2.0 side, but there's a lot of exciting things too. And yeah, James, he asks a lot of good questions. He seems to me to be relatively negative on Ethereum. So it was kind of funny when I saw this first get posted. I'm like, okay, well, this is obviously going to be kind of a negative article, but it ended up not being that at all. And then, yeah, like you mentioned, the people that reviewed it, I guess that just means they're all converting over to be Ethereum people like all of us, right? I'm sure they're going to love that comment, but no, it's good to see honest and good analysis on ETH 2.0. And I think the discussion in general is really picking up on this as the teams are starting to form that are building the different clients and it's starting to become more real. We're going to have testnet soon. So I think a lot of people are just starting to focus on it a little bit more. And I'm sure we're going to see more of this analysis start to come out over time.
Yeah, exactly. There were a lot of open questions in the article around the later phases of ETH 2.0, especially like phase 3 and 4, I think. Even phase 1 and 2 haven't been fleshed out too much yet because everyone's focused on phase 0 and getting the beacon chain up and running. So there's a lot of disjointed research posts and random comments and you know, mind maps and things like that for the later phases. So it was great that this was brought to, you know, front and center. Vitalik's comments covered a few of that, but we need to keep thinking about these things because phase 0 is just the beginning. It's literally just the beacon chain where you won't even be able to move your ETH. You'll just be able to send ETH there to stake as a one-way bridge at the moment, and you won't be able to move your ETH or do anything with it. It's literally locked for potentially, 1 to 2 years until phase 1 rolls out. So I think we really do need to be thinking about the later phases at this stage. I think that's picking up. The spec on GitHub seems to be getting a bit more work done to it and a bit more formalization done. So it's great to see that happening. But yeah, so we do need more posts like this. So I call any maybe not maximalists, but any people who maybe are bearish on Ethereum in general to provide some objective analysis. Obviously, Eric and I are quite biased in our analysis. We try to be as objective as possible, but we are big fans of Ethereum, so we might be blinded by that sometimes and not see the negatives in it. So it's great to see people like this, you know, keeping the Ethereum community in check, especially on Twitter as well. You know, we invite valid criticism. We don't like things like people lying about how, you know, how hard it is to run a full node. I'm running 3 nodes on my PC right now. Like, you know what I mean? Like in different VMs and things like that. It's not hard to run a full node. And just spreading that misinformation is what really annoys us. So objective analysis, like what James has written, is the way to go about it, because then you'll get better conversations as well. You won't get us repeating the same stuff and linking to our ETH Hub page, running an Ethereum node that clearly explains how easy it is to get up and running with it. So yeah, just basically a call out to anyone. You can DM us, you can tweet at us. We're happy to help wherever. We're happy to answer questions. We're happy to take the feedback on board. And I'm sure all the researchers in Ethereum are as well. You can always open issues on GitHub and go into the Gitter, as long as you're not trolling, basically.
Yeah, definitely. Just be sure not to do objective analysis on Bitcoin or you'll get personally attacked, like, you know, asking if the 21 million cap is actually economically viable.
Yeah. I think there's a lot of fighting that goes on Twitter, maybe unnecessary fighting, unfortunately, but it's kind of like he said, she said. A lot of the Twitter fights. Twitter's just not a great platform for debate or argumentation or things like that. So I think it's better to do it in DMs or you know, even old fashioned through email, I guess, or wherever else. I think on Twitter, you reply to someone and then they eventually stop replying, or it's like a mob mentality. Their followers start piling onto you, or your followers start piling onto them, and it gets all messy and stuff. So it's not the greatest platform for debate, I think. All right, that's it for this week, everyone. Thank you for listening. So if you want to subscribe to the newsletter so you get it before the podcast goes live, go to ethhub.substack.com. You can read the issue that we just spoke about there as well. Subscribe on there. And definitely don't forget to subscribe to the podcast that you're listening to right now, so you don't miss any of the episodes that we put out. So have a good week, everyone. We'll be back next week with another one.
Thanks for listening to the Into the Ether podcast. You can subscribe to us at podcast.ethhub.io, as well as follow us on Twitter at econoar and at zazzle0x.